Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. And on the show today, we'll begin by talking about how to deal with weeds practically and organically. Tasha Greer is back with us. She's a homesteader, writer focused on simple, sustainable living. She's a contributor to Mother Earth News, The Grow Network, Grit, and Morning Chores. She's also the host of a video educational series on the Grow Network. Her new book is Weed-Free Gardening, a comprehensive and organic approach to weed management. So, are you having problems with weeds? I guess we all do. If you're a gardener, there's always something that's bothering us and relating to weeds. And so, be a good time for you to join in with your own questions about controlling them, perhaps. Or maybe you've got some ideas of your own, or maybe you've got some really good tools that you use for getting rid of those weeds that you don't want. You can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Tasha Greer, welcome. Thanks for coming back and being with us again.
Oh, Larry, it's great to talk to you again.
You know what? You, as I understand it, you live on about 10 acres and you got about an acre and a half of garden, which is a pretty darn good-sized garden, if you ask me.
Yeah.
I think the biggest one I ever had, aside from my mother's garden, you know, we grew up on a farm and had a great, you know, we had an acre garden too, but I think the biggest one I've ever handled myself was 12 by 70, which is pretty good.
That's pretty big too.
That's pretty big too. But you tell us about your garden.
Well, we actually bought this property that was kind of an eroded mountainside. Somebody had cleared it and then not planted anything, so it really didn't have any soil. So a lot of what I call gardening is really just me finding ways to make soil. And so I learned a lot about weeds because, you know, using weeds to make soil is a really good method when you can't afford to buy that many plants. And so our property has, like, bit by bit become more, ready for cultivated plants. So a lot of what I'm doing is, like, food forest, permaculture kind of things to really improve the soil. And those systems, once you get them in place, don't take a lot of work. And then I've got like four more garden rooms, I guess, where I do a lot of the more cultivated plants and the fruits and vegetables and flowers and things like that. So it's kind of like a mishmash of, you know, plants, places where I allow a lot of weeds and actually use them actively, and places where I really kind of control and stick to more cultivated plants. So, and part of that, acreage is also part of a pasture that might use. And a lot of people think that a pasture is kind of a no-maintenance thing, but you actually have to do quite a bit of gardening to maintain a pasture for a home herd.
Well, you've got goats and chickens and ducks and worms.
When you have this big of a garden, you need a fertility source. So livestock tends to work really well with organic gardening.
Oh, man. Susanna in Stoughton already has a question about a weed, so maybe we'll just go there right away and get it over with. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I actually have a question about two different weeds, and the first is my arch nemesis, which is creeping bellflower, and I don't believe that I'll ever be able to completely eradicate it, but I'm wondering if there are some management techniques that can help me stay ahead of it. That maybe aren't, I don't know, that maybe can offer some efficiency.
Mm-hmm. What's the other one? Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I was just going to say, the second you say creeping, I don't even have to know the weed, but creeping weeds, you know, they either move slightly under soil or above soil, and so they're kind of problematic because, they kind of sneak around, and so they do require more control than, say, a plant that just stays in one place. And I think, you know, if you can isolate them to a specific area, then it's a lot easier to control. Sometimes sort of digging sort of a ditch that they can't pass over, just like a little trench, and then just sort of pick away at that area. But a lot of those creepers really respond extremely well to like mulches and lots of compost and organic matter. So sometimes just stopping the flow a little bit and slowing down the amount of mulch and things that you're putting on the ground can kind of dry them out a bit and make them easier to get control of.
Yeah. Susan, what have you done so far to control?
So far, it's just digging. And it's so insidious because it moves with rhizomes, but then it also puts down these deep carrots. And so even places like when we moved onto our property, there was a bunch of, which I'm not a fan of, but black plastic landscaping paper nothing grows under because it kills the soil except for creeping bellflower. And it just runs like highways. So it's
a lot of people do, you know, use like a pond liner, some black plastic, and the rhizomes, they just grow under the soil outside of the coverage area. So sometimes it's, like I said, that trenching method really kind of helps. But there's not, for rhizomal runners, there's not a whole lot you can do other than digging. But depending on how deep they are, something like a hula hoe, you might be able to sort of scrape them up really quick. Rather than just digging up each one individually. So if you can get the ones that aren't so connected to the soil, then you can go back and you'll see the ones that you didn't really get, and then you can dig up those ones a little bit more.
Yeah, that's not a bad approach. You know, and it's creep. They're pretty, if you keep at it, isn't it, Tasha, that if you just kind of keep at it, pulling those creepers up off the ground and getting their leaves and so forth away and out of business?
Yeah, it's easier if they creep above ground. When they're underground, you don't always realize they're creeping yet. So that's why, like I said, I always like to sort of just, you know, maybe dig a 6-inch or, you know, 6-inch wide, 4 to 6-inch deep sort of trench just to, like, stop it. Say you're not crossing this line. There's no soil there for you. And so they don't tend to go deeper. They won't usually, like, dig down below the 6 inches. So you can kind of just sort of, it's like a fire break, except for instead of breaking the fire, you're breaking the weeds' access to easy-to-move-in soil. So.
Suzanne, you had another weed you wanted to ask about?
Yeah, and this one is a little heartbreaking to me because I've recently been informed that Siberian squill is like really horribly invasive, not just because of where it shows up, but because it actually changes the chemically changes the soil composition to make it. And I've always loved them because it's like, oh, something beautiful early on. But I'm wondering if I have to do my due diligence and rip out the squill that I see in order to protect and maintain a native environment. Do you have any insights on that?
And that's a really, I'm so glad you brought up, I don't know that particular weed, but I'm glad you brought up this concept because there are a lot of weeds like the garlic mustard that's growing in the forests. And there are things, they actually change the chemical composition in the soil and they make it hard for organic plants or for native plants to grow. A lot of times they'll cultivate relationships with bacteria that allow them to get more nitrogen out of the soil. So then when your native plants try to grow, there's no nitrogen. And so they are really problematic. As far as control, you know, sometimes there are actually legal regulations. And if that's the case, then, yeah, you kind of do want to do your due diligence and your civic duty. But sometimes it's more like, okay, this is a problem. And, you know, we don't want to let it get out of hand. But if you can isolate it somehow, like, you know, if you have some kind of break of, you know, a hedge or something that kind of won't stop it from transferring seeds or things to other places, that can help too. I'm kind of where I'm at in my landscape. I'm surrounded by, you know, hundreds of feet of forest. And so I always just keep things from going into the forest. So if there's something on my property that I'm using that, you know, the farmer, you know, 3 acres over would have a problem, you know, with getting on his property, I make sure I keep it out of the tree line. That way it doesn't accidentally spread over to his property. So sometimes if it's legal, yeah, you really need to do your best to control it. But if it's just one of those things that we're discouraged from planting, then you have to think, is this going to impact and hurt somebody else if I don't control it? Or are there ways that I can confine it to a specific area? That way I can still enjoy it, but I'm not putting our environment at risk. Hmm. So I think it is sort of one of those situations where you have to know the extent of how damaging that that weed is. But the other thing is, since you are impacting the soil structure underneath, are other things growing after that, or is it kind of preventing the natural succession of things, you know, growing and continuing to add carbon to the soil? So if it's preventing other things from growing after, then you might want to think about, you know, something that, that fills a similar function but doesn't have such a negative impact on the soil.
Yeah, there you go. Suzanne, thank you so much for calling.
Those are great questions.
Yeah, you can join in too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. You know, talking about the kinds of problems there with leaving a sort of a chemical in the ground or changing the earth, it's one of the problems that weeds can cause, I guess, that aren't quite apparent on the surface.
Definitely. And I think sometimes weeds are actually changing the environment, and sometimes weeds are solving problems that we may not be aware of. And so that's why sort of one of the things I always do before I control a weed is I research it and I find out what sort of scholarly studies have been done on, you know, its impacts on the environment. And so a lot of times, you know, you can read these abstracts of scholarly research and it'll tell you, oh, okay, this plant is, you know, cultivating a bacteria, or it's, you know, taking excess water out of the soil, or it might be performing some kind of useful function that you can then look at your garden and go, ah, okay, so this is a really wet spot. That's why this plant has decided to be there, because this plant is, you know, something that likes boggy areas and actually helps dry them out. But sometimes you could be looking at it and you could be like, okay, this is a plant that really only works with a couple of bacteria, and so that means that you might not have a whole lot of soil fertility in the first place, and so that plant might be the only thing that can grow there until you improve the soil life underneath, you know, by adding more diversity and starting to use things like compost to increase the fertility. But there are those that are just they have a natural advantage.
Yeah,
they're allelopathic is actually the word that we use, and they secrete chemicals and things into the soil that make it hard for other plants to grow. And so those guys tend to be detrimental to your existing plants. And so it kind of becomes, you know, if you want to keep growing these other things, then you'll need to dig those guys up.
Tasha Greer, our guest today, she's the author of Weed-Free Gardening, A Comprehensive and Organic Approach to Weed Management. Jill Nadeau is our producer today. Clara Neipert, our on-air producer. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network, talking with Tasha Greer today, the author of Weed-Free Gardening, A Comprehensive and Organic Approach to Weed Management. She's written a number of books and contributes to a number of publications and hosts a video educational series on the Grow Network as well. So it's great to have her with us, and every one of her lines is filled. So let's go to the phones, and Cody and Eau Claire, on to you. Thank you for calling, Cody.
Hey, sorry to keep talking about the weeds. But I'm planning to kind of regrade my lawn. I'm going to till up the whole thing, kind of smooth it out. And we have problems with Creeping Charlie, and we're just wondering what may be the best way to address that so that it wouldn't come back when we take and fertilize it and reseed it later. So,
yeah.
That's a great question. Creeping Charlie is one of those plants that really likes moisture. So I would guess that you might be retaining a little bit of extra moisture in the places where it's more prolific. Does that sound right?
It may be. I don't think there's a ton of moisture in our lawn. I just think it's kind of had some free rain. And I know some people, when they plant gardens, they'll put tarps down the season before just to kill everything. I don't know if that is really feasible for a whole lawn, but...
Cody, if you've got neighbors with Creeping Charlie, you are not going to get rid of creeping, Charlie. that's my experience anyway. And well, go ahead, Tasha. Do you have some advice for?
Yeah, I would say the other thing too is that, and it's just sort of a generally good practice. A lot of people mow a little bit too close, and so when you mow closer, then you sort of create these dry, wet cycles in your soil, and so that's where a lot of weeds will sort of take advantage of where maybe the shallower roots of grass have you know been a little bit stressed either by too much moisture or too much dryness, and so they'll just kind of sneak into a little bit of root space that's been made. So when you keep your grass higher, if you can keep it closer to 4 inches instead of mowing below, you know, that line, then a lot of times you're shading and protecting the soil below, and you're also encouraging deeper roots. So the deeper your grass roots, the less likely it is that plants like Creeping Charlie will be able to set down a new root system because there's already an existing root system in their way. So it's, I think to some extent you just need to control the worst parts and expect that you'll get some occasional outbreaks if you've got it already sort of persisted in your environment. But when you're talking about regrading, if you just kind of just sort of walk around barefooted if you can and see if there are places where the soil feels cooler and more moist and see if that's where you're having more problems, because it might just be that you need to more heavily seed there, or maybe pick a kind of grass that likes a little bit more moisture.
And if you cut it, at 3 to 4 inches, then you're if you cut lower than that, what you're doing is you're stressing your lawn grass and making it tough for it to compete with other plants. And if you cut it higher, you'll actually wind up mowing less.
Yes, absolutely. You'll retain more water and keep the soil cooler, so your grass will be less stressed, and it's all around better for everybody, I think.
Cody, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Jerry in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Larry. Cody, I would take Creeping Charlie any day over my garden nemesis, which is Bishop's Weed. I think it's also called gout weed. I pulled up buckets and buckets of it in the fall, thinking I had weeded very thoroughly, and now I see those insidious tiny little leaves poking out already. Anything I could do about Bishop's Weed?
I'm not familiar with that weed. That's the other thing, is we all have different weeds that we're facing. But can you tell me, do you know how it starts? Does it start by seed, or does it just regrow from maybe missed roots? Do you have any idea how it's starting?
I think it's really hard to get all of the root system out because it has such a network of roots, and it seems like it only takes a little root about an eighth of an inch long to turn into a whole plant in a month or so.
Yep. So those kind of plants, they're self-cloning, and it's either it'll clone by roots or it might have some rhizomes or things that it's spreading from. Those are unfortunately the hardest to control, and the only way to fully control them is to dig them up. But you can sort of create a barrier similar to what we were talking about earlier. You can sort of just pick the zone where you're going to declare war on that weed. Either put, hammer some like metal or something around the edges to identify the bed area and keep the roots from spreading further underground, or dig a little bit of a trench and then just thoroughly control that. Now, if you've already got existing plants, you're probably not going to be able to get it out 100%, so there's going to be a lot of diligence and management. But if you can do a little bit more research on that weed and find out what its favorite environment is, and you might already know because of where it's growing in your garden, then if you could somehow make your environment a little bit less amenable to it, whether it's changing the drainage a little bit so that you redirect excess water, or if it likes a particular nutrient, then seeing if you could grow a cover crop to leach out that nutrient. A lot of times it just helps to know what the weed loves, and then you'll know what's going on in your soil, and you can take away the thing it loves most and slow it down quite a bit.
Yeah. It's a native of, I think it was brought over from Europe, gout weed, I think, is the other word for it, term for it. It's a very hard plant. I would really recommend Jerry taking a look at a bit more, as Tasha just said. Read up on it a bit more. There may be ways to deal with it that are non-chemical. The only ones I can think of are chemical at the moment, I believe.
Larry, two other ideas that might work, depending if it's just sort of getting going. You guys, I think, it might be a little cooler there still than it is here, which would make it cool to weed. So you could try like a propane torch, and you actually torch the root zone because you're trying to stress the root out and just sort of desiccate it. You don't want to kill the tops because obviously it'll just regrow. But if you can stress the root zone through repeated like heating of the soil, then that might help. Of course, don't do that when there's a fire risk or drought or anything.
No risk of fire today here in Wisconsin. lots of good rain because in southern Wisconsin, we were quite deficient in, several inches behind. So this rain is quite welcomed to southern Wisconsin for sure. Jerry, thanks. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Barb in Hazelhurst, we'll go to you now. Hi, Barb.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Tasha.
Hey, Barb,
I made the mistake. I'm fine, thank you. We have a raised flower bed in front of our deck. It's about 8 foot by 4 foot. And I made the mistake of planting yarrow, which was beautiful at the beginning. And now it's, I think, similar to the other callers. I had my husband dig it up, and I've got these rhizomes. Am I going to have difficulty planting something as a replacement in that area?
Yes, so yarrow, it actually spreads by seed very easily as well as by rhizomes. So even if you got every one of those rhizomes, you probably still have some seeds in there. So I would recommend, if you can, just try to grow some cover crops or grow something really aggressive that's going to outcompete that plant. I wouldn't try putting plants in there that are going to be slow to start right away. So if if you're not in a huge hurry, maybe get some big dahlia tubers or something, so you'll get this, lot of growth. And then you can just let them die back over winter and grow something next year. But if you can get something that will save the soil, take up a lot of the nutrients, something with the tuber is really good for that, or any kind of bulbs and things like that, but that aren't going to be permanently there. That way, in case some do come back, it's still okay to dig next year. Because I think it'll probably take you 2 or 3 years to get them completely out of there, given that they reseed so easily.
Yeah, for sure. Barb, good luck. Thank you. Cindy in Illinois, your turn.
Hi, thank you. Tasha, two weeds that are just destroying my lawn, wild violet and plantain.
I bet you have a shady lawn.
Shady or compacted, that would be my two guesses.
Or shady and compacted.
Yeah, it could be that. So I think both of those are, so the violets, I think you can, if you can just pull those and reseed everywhere you pull them, and maybe just till a little bit before you reseed, that's probably going to be your best bet. And make sure you're using some kind of grass variety that's suited for your soil. So if you haven't done a soil test or check with your extension office to see what kind of grasses they recommend, because a lot of times we're putting in grasses that might not be perfect for the conditions that are actually on the ground. And so these weeds kind of make some headway. Plantain is definitely a sign of compaction. So those weeds really need like a nice tight soil to even get started, because the seeds get worn by abrasion between small soil particles. So I would maybe think about doing some aeration or a little light tilling wherever you're having that. And then those are annuals, so if you just make sure they don't self-sow, they'll time out as long as you get address that compaction problem. And you may want to add a little bit of more compost or something like that too, just to increase the fertility, because those are also usually signs of low fertility.
Good luck, Cindy. Thank you so much for calling. Well, we have some open lines and get you on pretty quickly here. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@WPR.org. Tasha Greer, our guest today, her book that we're kind of talking about is Weed Free Gardening, A Comprehensive and Organic Approach to Weed Management. Actually, in the book, you divide weeds into, five types? Five different types.
Yeah. I kind of don't, the word weed always scares me because sometimes, we're just talking about wild vegetation and some of it's native, some of it's naturalized, and these plants may not actually be having a negative impact on our environment. I always, for me, when I'm talking about weeds, I try to reserve that word for things that are harmful, either to my gardening goals or to, to the broader ecological environment.
And weeds, many times people have said, well, a weed is a plant that is growing where you don't want it to grow.
Yeah, plant out of place. But sometimes it's a plant solving a problem. So that's the reason I kind of divide things out, into different categories. Because, if you've just disturbed the soil, you've set up so that you could plant some plants, you got to expect weeds to show up. So in that kind of scenario, it's really just that you've disturbed the soil, you've exposed old weed seeds. So you're just going to kind of control those for a while. But if you've been gardening in a place for a long time and all of a sudden a brand new weed starts showing up and you haven't done anything like tilling or maybe you brought in some new organic matter or something like that, you need to figure out, is there a new situation causing this weed or did I just maybe bring it in with my soil amendments? And that can kind of guide whether you need to control it or if you need to solve a deeper problem before you try to control it.
Nancy in Mineral Point has a question for you. Hi, Nancy. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question about asparagus.
Okay.
I'm not a very good gardener. We grow asparagus and rhubarb. That's about it. but right now I've got green stuff, weeds, coming up in the asparagus patch. Is it too late to get some mulch on that before the spears appear?
So I would actually recommend, maybe doing a little bit of surface weeding before you put the mulch down, because a lot of weeds actually benefit from mulch if it's applied after they've already come up, because they'll be that nice, easy to move through organic matter. So if you could just maybe kind of hoe around the area a little bit, if you're able to get down and do a little bit of hand weeding, I would try to get any little seedlings that are down there popping up. And if there are any bigger, deeper weeds, if you can try to just sort of carefully excavate those so that you don't accidentally nick your asparagus spears as they're coming up, then, give everything a good watering. Well, if you've been having rain, then you just had a nice gift from nature. But then you could put down a little bit of maybe compost or some leaf mold or something that's very light. You don't want to put anything woody at this point because it could definitely damage your spears. But you could put an inch or so of something light just to sort of suppress new seedlings.
All right. Good luck, Nancy. Thank you. Julie in Waupaca, your turn. Hi, Julie.
Hi. I have a question about Virginia creeper.
Okay.
It is overtaking my cottage land space, and it's dangerous because it trips you. Do you have any suggestions to how to control that, please?
Yeah, I would say again that when you get to that word creeper, you're any kind of spreader by rhizomes, you always have to do sort of that underground digging to get those out. And so none of the, putting down plastic or things like that aren't really going to be effective because they're able to basically transmit nutrients across those rhizomal root systems. And so, I think, unfortunately, just getting down and trying to weed it or using a hula hoe, if you have any deeper roots, maybe something like a soil knife or even going into a long spade. But then you sort of mark out your territory and say, I'm going to not let it come back into this zone because you might, you probably can't control it all if it's already a very big spreading mess. But you draw a line and say, this is a place I won't let you cross. And if it crosses into that zone, then you have to control it some more. But there's spreaders sometimes too. I don't know that one in particular, but it might be responding to an excess of certain nutrients in your soil. So if you haven't had a soil test lately and it's really spreading all over the place and growing equally well everywhere, then you might be, you know, high in phosphorus or something like that. So it might also be worth finding out what nutrient you're high in so that you could grow a cover crop or something to try to take that back out of the soil and slow down its growth processes.
Yeah, a lot of our soils in the state are plenty full of phosphorus already.
Yeah, and so phosphorus, one of the things I like for fighting a phosphorus excess is crimson clover, because it you can plant it in the fall, it'll grow through winter, and then it'll really start to take off in the spring as it warms up. So a lot of those spreaders, it can kind of interfere with their life cycle, and because it draws out so much of the phosphorus into its leaves and its flowers, it can actually slow them down quite a bit.
Julie, thank you again for calling. Leanne in Marathon, on to you now. Hi, Leanne.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm excited about this because actually I attended the Garden Expo again this spring, and I attended a presentation about wild edibles. And so now this season I'm looking for it, instead of weeding, harvesting these wild edibles that I'm so excited about. Because I looked at my friend that I went with when we went to the into the seminars, and I said, oh my gosh, I've been just throwing all this into my compost, and now this year I'm going to harvest these. There's a number of I'm trying to think off the top of my head what the different weeds or, you know, that I have tons in my garden, and I always just weeding them, and I'm like, this year I'm going to harvest them and eat them. And the person that I seminar that I attended was by Samuel Thayer, and he is through the Forager's Harvest. He has a website if you want that, and he has a number of books as references that are very, very nicely done. And like I said, and instead of this year going, oh, I got to go weed, I'm going to go harvest in my garden all those previous weeds.
And Sam Thayer has been on the show, on this show, a number of times. But, well, Tasha, what about those weeds? You know about some weeds that are pretty good to eat.
I absolutely agree. Like your caller who was asking about plantain, I make plantain tea because the leaves are really good. If you have any like chest congestion or asthma or anything, they're not going to cure and solve your problems, but the tea is really soothing. So a lot of things, if you can find a use for it and harvest it happily instead of fighting it, that's certainly the best strategy for me. So like here, we have a lot of Bradford or Callery pear trees that just like germinate because we're in a woodland area. And so they start all over the place, and they actually, there's a bounty. Like if you dig them up, then, you know, you can get paid money here in our state. But I just continually coppice them, and then I dry them, and I use them for, like, steaks in my garden. So it's not – I eat plenty of weeds, dandelions, hairy bittercress are some of my favorites, certainly anything nettle, a lot of the mints, like the henbit I feed to my henbit, and dead nettle I feed to my chickens. So there's lots of good uses for them. But even the ones like the trees that are a little harder to control, if you just keep mowing them to the ground, and then you can use the – they'll keep recoppicing, but they get weaker each time, and you can use that coppiced wood as garden decorations or, you know, kindling or something if you have a fire pit. So there's lots of ways to think of these things as resources. I always like to look back to sort of the olden days and find out what did people do in the past before they could go to the grocery store or the hardware store. And a lot of weeds really served purposes that we now spend money to go buy something to do.
Leanne, thank you for calling. And Donna in Cedarburg, on to you now. Your turn. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a problem. We have a flower garden in the back, and at one time we planted some grape hyacinths, which are so beautiful in the spring, but we didn't realize how much they would spread. And last year, all of a sudden, we saw we had grape hyacinths many places, and I spent the summer digging them out, and I have a lot of little bulbs besides the big bulbs under them. If you miss any of those, they grow again. And it's sort of a warning to people that this is a plant that spreads, but I'm also not sure how I'm going to get rid of them. It's just a lot of down-in-the-dirt digging, I think.
Yeah, I would actually, whenever I have, like, bulbs and things that reproduce in my garden where I don't want them, I kind of just keep mowing them down, or whenever they peek through the ground, I cut them with scissors, because those bulbs, if you keep cutting down the greens, they can't recharge the bulbs or the corms, or underground tubers. They can't recharge because they need photosynthesis to do that. So what they do is they spend all of the energy that's inside the bulb trying to push up new greens to get to the surface and photosynthesize so they can recharge and you know, reproduce more bulbs. So I actually, a lot of times I even plant things like that in the ground so that they'll reproduce and I can keep mowing the tops because they really enrich the soil. So if you can just take a pair of scissors and if you can recognize the greens when they come up, you know, or even just a scythe or something like that, or a string trimmer, you can actually really benefit your soil just by mowing those down, and then the parts that stay in the ground and eventually just sort of rot, they actually add organic matter and deepen your soil profile. So I kind of find those to be really useful weeds.
And they're pretty. Grape hyacinths.
Yeah, they're pretty, but if you don't, you know, if you've got a beautiful flower bed and that's not what you want to be seeing, you still have to control them.
Oh, boy. Tasha Greer, our guest today. She's the author of the book Weed Free Gardening, A Comprehensive and Organic Approach to Weed Management. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. By the way, you can join in too. The number to call 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest Tasha Greer, author of Weed Free Gardening, A Comprehensive and Organic Approach to Weed Management. Questions for her? Give a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. You know, somebody was wondering, asking, what the heck's a hula hoe? You've mentioned that a couple of times, and maybe talk about that. But then also tell us more about how your book is organized. Really attractive book, and I think well laid out.
Thank you. Well, a hula hoe is, that's actually the only hoe I really use. it looks a little like a hula hoop. It's got an open center. And so the thing about it is that you can kind of control how deep your disturbance goes by the size of the hula hoe. So, you know, you can go, if it's got a 2-inch hole or a 3-inch hole in the center, then you're only going to be disturbing the root network down to that 2 or 3 inches. So that won't, you know, you won't accidentally hit the deeper roots of some of your shrubs and things like that. So, but it's really good on like shallow seedlings or anything that's like annuals that are taprooted and have like a head on the top, you know, a central plant. And then also for just loosening up those creepers so that you can go through, because they usually don't root so deeply all over the place. They might find a good spot and put down deeper roots, but a lot of the shallower places where they're just sort of starting, if you run that hula hoe, you get underneath them, and then you can just kind of go through and dig them out of the soil a little bit easier than actually like getting out a shovel. So, but yeah, if you haven't seen a hula hoe, that's one of my favorite ones.
If I'm not
there
mistaken,
are a lot of different hoes.
I think you even have a picture of one in your book here. But tell us again, or tell our listeners how you've got your book organized.
Yeah, I started with the introduction, and on the very front table of contents, I say the war on weeds, why it can't be won, and how to make peace in the garden. Because I think that one of the things we have to do before we start becoming weed-free organic gardeners is to realize that our relationship with plants, the way that we think of anything that, you know, that volunteers in our garden is, it's a little bit modern and maybe even outdated given our, you know, all the challenges that we have controlling weeds these days. And so if we can maybe get back to the perspective of thinking of wild vegetation not necessarily as something that has to be controlled, but as something that we are never, ever really going to control, so can we figure out how to work with it? You know, because herbicides are an invention of the last 70 years, and they're not something that are going to continue. I mean, everybody's already trying to find new solutions because they're timing out. So I think in the introduction, I really just sort of try to set the framework for why having no weeds isn't really something we should be aspiring to. And then I break the book down into four parts. And the first part is prevention. And prevention to me is looking at the weeds that are already in your garden and saying, how can I change the situation so that these weeds won't keep reproducing and expand their territory? Because where there's one weed, there's always, you know, quite a bit more. So prevention actually starts with looking at the weeds you already have to understand your soil better and make strategies for how to garden so that weeds don't just keep coming over and over again. And then also sometimes we bring weeds in through the things that we do, like buying compost or mulch and bringing in new plants. And so there's some ways that you can minimize the impact of new weeds that show up because of your purchases. So then on to part two, it's maintenance. And this is really where I start talking about the soil, because I think the one connection that a lot of people don't realize, you know, is that weeds are a response to a condition in the soil. Sometimes it's just that your soil is fertile and you don't have enough plants growing to, you know, prevent light from getting down to the soil. So it's really just a matter of, hey, you've got an opportunity to plant more plants. But sometimes there's something fundamentally going wrong in the soil, like for some reason the pH is changing or a new weed has moved in and is altering the chemical composition. So it's really trying to understand your soil and what those weeds are reacting to in the soil. Part three is reconciliation, and that's where I really get into the point that that carbon is the thing that feeds the soil system. And so if you don't have enough plants growing, then weeds are probably going to come to try to give more carbon into the soil. So at that point, you can either use those weeds and take them as a resource and a gift, or you can figure out something better to plant and thank those weeds for alerting you to the fact that you kind of need to do something more. So it's really just kind of making peace with the free plants and then moving on to other things. And that's what part four is, really creating peace in the garden. And that's where, when you've already dealt with weed prevention, maintenance, and reconciliation, then you really kind of get to the creative process of making the garden a beautiful sanctuary, which is, I think, what we all want from our gardens.
Yeah. And you've got some beautiful photography to go along with this. Were all those were the photos all on your property?
Most of them. I actually I only have a couple camera lenses because I'm not really a photographer. So some of the larger shots, we actually had to go find those. So there were a couple other, I think there are four or five photos that I didn't take, but most of them are my property. And one of the things I really kind of show off is that when we moved to our property in 2014, we really had almost no weeds because we had almost no soil. And then using a mix of weeds and organic mulch and selected plants, we now have really an extremely abundant, just lush, full property that with year-round interest. And it's only happened in a few years. And growing weeds actually helped with that a lot.
Well, it's a wonderful book and a really fun read, too, as a matter of fact.
Thank you.
Jeff in Green Bay, though, has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Is there any truth to the fact that in lieu of Roundup, I can use a solution of salt and water in a sprayer? I've got some cobblestone roads around my property, and, you know, that weeds are crazy, and I hate using Roundup.
So I will tell you that salt is really like the first herbicide. It definitely damages the soil so much that you will have a hard time growing cultivated plants there, and weeds will probably just kind of become the worse weeds that are salt tolerant rather than solving the problem. So it will work to kill some weeds, absolutely. But I really recommend for like a cobble path or something using more like a propane torch or boiling water. That way you're not making any permanent chemical alterations to your soil. Any kind of heating element will definitely, you know, if you can get the roots warmed up, that will kill the it will kill the roots of the plant by desiccating them. And the other thing, though, is that a lot of cobblestones, flagstones, surfaces like that, they actually collect organic matter and they become a perfect place for weeds to get started because they also pool a little water and things like that. And they stay cooler because of like the mortar and materials actually kind of moderate the temperature. So if you can maybe take a power washer and clean your cobblestones and get out some of that organic matter, then weeds will be less likely to show up. So I've got a flagstone area that I have to power wash every 2 years. Otherwise, it becomes a planting bed.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Joan from Watertown, your turn. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I grew up on the Bark River in Summit, Wisconsin, and my mother grew up in Appalachia, and she would have me and my sister go out every spring and all summer long, really, with a picking pan and a little knife, and we would pick all of the greens that were growing. She just called them greens, growing in the yard. Yeah. And, of course, dandelion leaves and especially the roots are extremely healthy. They're healthy for every system of the body, especially the urinary tract and the blood flow and everything. And she said, we need to pick these greens to clean our blood in the spring. And so when I started working on organic farms, you know, the farmers would have us pulling all those weeds out and throwing them in the compost pile or just leaving them lay. And I couldn't stand it after years of doing that. I thought, well, I am going to start gardening myself. So I'm a market gardener now in Watertown. And I sell these wild greens, for instance, lamb's quarters. People love it. Mm-hmm. I sell big bunches of lamb's quarters, which come up in the garden prolifically. And it's a wild spinach. It's very similar to spinach. And people just love it. The plantain. Creeping Charlie, I know, is one thing. I know Larry doesn't like Creeping Charlie, but Creeping Charlie is very high in vitamin C. And it's a wonderful tea. You take a big handful of it and put it in a mug with some hot water in the wintertime to cure a cold as you feel a cold coming on. All these things are so healthy, and Mother Nature brings them to us, and they're wild, and so they're all the more healthy. I've had families of kids come to my garden, and when they get off out of the bus or off out of their car, we start walking, and I say, what do you think is the most healthy thing in the garden? And, you know, they come up with all these different things, carrots, you know, lettuce, whatever. And I say, it's what you're standing on right now. It's what you're standing on, all these weeds, you know.
Well, and Joan, I have to tell you, I feel better about Creeping Charlie than I used to feel, because one of the things, and we've talked about this on the show in the past, but they're one of the first things to bloom in the spring. And so for pollinating insects, they're a source of food. And when there isn't a whole lot else available for us here in Wisconsin, for the, you know, we don't have your winters, Tasha.
Yeah, no. And I think that's a really powerful story, but it's absolutely true. I mean, I'm a homesteader. And so, you know, we grow our nutrition. And so I have tons of lands. I grow south thistle. I mean, these are in my cultivated garden because they grow better and are easier to harvest in good soil than they do in sort of thin, more weed-prone soil. So I actually, like, I've taken the seeds from lovely plants in other places and put them in cultivated parts of my yard, because you can get so many vitamins from small quantities of these wild weeds. I mean, they're not really weeds. They're herbs that we've just kind of forgotten the power of. And so that's a great story.
Joan, yeah, thanks very much for calling. And it kind of goes back to what you were talking about earlier, with the fact that way back when, people like Joan's mother probably grew up with that sort of knowledge of the usefulness of those plants before. They didn't call them weeds then.
Mm-hmm. They just looked forward to their season whenever they would be at peak, ready for harvest.
Do you ever harvest thistle in the spring?
I do thistle, but I really love to leave thistle for the butterflies because it's one of their favorites. So what I normally do is I let thistle grow because it's really an excellent soil amendment. Mm-hmm. But then I harvest the flowers, and after the bees have had their opportunity and the butterflies, and I use them for flower arrangements, and then I throw the seed. Because I love them, but I don't want more of them.
Tasha Greer, our guest today. She's the author of Weed Free Gardening, a comprehensive and organic approach to weed management. She's also the author of Grow Your Own Spices, and she has a host of a video education series on the Grow Network. And as I said, her new book, Weed Free Gardening, a comprehensive and organic approach to weed management. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Tasha Greer, talking with her about dealing with weeds practically and organically. She's a homesteader, writer focused on simple, sustainable living. And she's writes for a number of publications and as a host of a video educational series on the Grow Network. And her new book is Weed Free Gardening, a comprehensive and organic approach to weed management. We have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly now. If you're having a problem, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Herb sent us an email. He says, I just lost his... I found it again on my computer screen. He's starting to use a paper roll 36 inches wide for a mulch to fight weeds. The product is called Weed Guard Plus. He's wondering how much of this product would prevent water infiltration from his plants. And any other hints on using this type of product would be helpful.
Yeah, I don't know that particular product, but I use rolls of paper all the time in the garden, and they don't normally seem to prevent water infiltration, but if you do get a lot of rain, they tend to actually break down pretty quickly, so the protection time really relates to how much water does filter through, and the thickness. So, if you use cardboard, less will filter through, but then as it degrades, it'll kind of just hold moisture in place. And so papers definitely reduce weeds. They're best on sort of the annuals that have a short life cycle because if they don't hurry up and grow and flower, then they won't reproduce. So they often give up kind of easy if they're not having any luck. But it won't really be effective on any of the sort of creeping or rhizomal plants. And it may actually make it a little bit worse because it helps retain moisture. And so they are able to spread more easily underneath the soil below. So I love using paper because it adds carbon to the soil. It helps regulate soil temperature too. So for whatever you put under plant in the paper, those plants will be a little bit less stressed. They'll really kind of like that environment, but it can definitely exacerbate rhizomal spreaders. So it really just depends on what kind of weeds you're fighting them, trying to fight with the paper.
Catherine from Marshfield sent an email. She's a garden that's 25 by 60 feet that has gone to weeds for about 5 years, and she'd like to smother the weeds before resuming gardening or maybe even turning some of it back into lawn. But she has lots of old newspapers, corrugated cardboard, and plastic tarps, and wonders if she can use these to get rid of most of these weeds.
Yeah, I can't say most because it depends on what the weeds are, but yeah. It's always a nice first effort to, if you're just dealing with a really bad situation, if you mow it all down, and then if you can just kind of take a little look to see kind of what the root system of the weeds after you mow down the green, so that you can kind of see if they look like a lot of just rapid spreaders or are they a lot of tap-rooted plants, then you can kind of make a better strategy. So if they're a lot of spreading plants, then adding cardboard and paper is not probably going to control them. But putting down, you know, some kind of plastic tarp for a year or two might. You need to do it longer than a year, though, to control those kind of rhizomal spreaders, and then just making sure they don't get out of the area that they're covered under. But you can also you can start gardening. You can go ahead and mow everything down, put down some paper, and then maybe grow some cover crops and things that are going to be as aggressive as weeds. And then they'll start to rob the plants of that are already there of some of their nutrients and their access to sun. So I really like a super weedy area like that. If you can put down some paper, a little bit of compost, and then just plan to grow as many cover crops as you can over the next year and then reclaim it for gardening, that will reduce a lot more weeds than trying to plant sort of not so fast growing cultivated plants right in that weedy protected soil.
Betty from Iowa sent an email. She says the best hoe she ever used is a Japanese style short handled hoe. It has a sharp steel blade. She likes it better than the hula hoe.
And I do like that one too, but I have really heavy clay and it's got like a blade on it that always gets dulled. So the hula hoop doesn't really have a blade, and so I just find that one a little bit better. But she's right, that's a great tool.
Roy in Toma, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Last fall, with all good intentions, we bought a bunch of tulip bulbs and, of course, never got around to planting them. Can we go ahead and plant them this spring?
What do they look like, Roy? are the bulbs still kind of hard?
Well, yeah. They look like they did when we bought them. But you know, I didn't know if we could still use them or have better intentions next year or next fall. I didn't know what to do with them.
Yeah, if they're still in good condition, because some tulips would already be up by now, and so those probably would already have forced some greens and things like that, and they might just rot if you put them in. But if they're later sort of, you guys are a little bit cooler anyway, so if they're the later starting tulips, they might still be okay. You might not get really good production, though, just because they won't have had long time to establish roots.
Yeah.
But rather than waste them, you could always try.
Yeah, I'd stick them in the ground. Yeah,
you could put them in some pots, and then you could harvest the bulbs and put them out next year.
That's not a bad idea. I like that idea. Roy, good luck. Thank you for calling. Rita in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Rita.
Hi. I have a problem with a garlic mustard, and it's growing within a sedum garden that I have, and I have some other small bushes in that garden, too. The only thing I could think of is digging up the sedum and picking all that garlic mustard out and then rounding up the area. Do you have a better idea?
Well, so garlic mustard is actually really delicious as pesto. So if you like to eat wild weeds, I would cut it back all the way. Just try to nick the crown if you can. And it'll put up some new leaves. And if you could just keep mowing it back, eventually that root system's going to give up. And it will, if you've got a few garlic mustard plants, you're probably going to have more because they probably self-sown quite a bit. So you'll probably have to do that for a couple of years. But if you can develop a taste for garlic mustard and make it fun to harvest, then I would go that route because they do develop pretty good roots. You're going to have to get out a long spade to really get them pulled up, and they're going to keep coming. So you're going to need a longer term plan. The other thing is that they are one of those plants that actually cultivate bacteria and get them to release nitrogen. So if you can get it so that they cultivate the bacteria and the nitrogen's available in the soil, and you're mowing them down repeatedly so that they're not actually using the nitrogen, then that nitrogen is actually available for your plants. So it's kind of worthwhile to just let them do their thing and just keep eating the greens if you don't mind to do the harvesting.
Rita, good luck. Appreciate your call. Yeah, that's garlic mustard is really hard to get rid of if you want to. It's really hard. Joshua in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Josh.
Yeah, I was calling. I have a small patch of yard in my back lawn that has been growing Japanese knotweed since. And I really don't want to use Roundup on it.
Yeah, Japanese knotweed is absolutely a plant where you're going to want to dig the entire roots because they've got really extensive root systems and they can regrow from small pieces. And so you're going to want to rip up that whole area and then sift through the soil before you put it back, or possibly even replace it if you're going to be putting in some kind of organic garden, if you want to start a vegetable bed or something. So when I see Japanese knotweed someplace, I always feel like that's a great opportunity to dig out the soil and start from scratch and bring in some new soil and new organic matter.
It's miserable.
But it is edible, so if it's, you know, if you're willing to eat it constantly, you have to peel the skins on the bigger pieces, but it tastes a little bit like artichokes, so that is one of those plants that people forage for often, but it is really an extensive root system that's hard to control.
And you might be pretty darn full of knotweed before you get rid of it.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, man. Well, you're getting a good dose here, Tasha, of the weeds that we have in Wisconsin and the worst ones, because I think practically nobody's mentioned Canada thistle yet. But
And Canada thistle is it's great because it's a soil tiller. It has a nice deep taproot, but you really have to mow it down about 50 times before it'll stop regrowing.
Jan in Viroqua, we'll go to you now. Hi, Jan.
Hello. The best weed control that I've found is to put down black fabric and then just slit a hole just large enough to put the seedling in. But I'm using a fabric that's good, that says it lasts 10 years, but I'm concerned that if I leave it down, I won't be able to add compost. Well, putting on compost tea and comfrey tea suffice, or should I pull it up each year and compost?
So you just asked, it's a really good process to use that landscape fabric on top of soil, and it will definitely reduce a lot of weeds, and then you just plant through a hole that you cut. That is all terrific. The thing I'm always concerned about with landscape fabric, and depending on what you're growing, is that it's a plastic fiber, and so it's going to degrade over time, and it's going to add plastic particles to the soil. So I always recommend rolling it up, over winter and things, when you're not gardening in there, that way it doesn't have extended contact with the soil if you can. And so then you could roll it up and put down some compost and grow a cover crop. And then next year you could roll it back out and put and use it to kill your cover crop, and then you can plant in it. And so that way it's not getting so weathered so much. And so it's not shedding so many of those microplastics. So I'm always I do use landscape fabric sometimes, but I just try to be conscientious about how many years I keep it in the garden, and trying to just expose it to as few seasons as possible. So only using it during the active growing season. It's also nice if you spread a little bit of straw or something on top of it just to protect it from the sun. And then watering through with compost tea is a lovely way of just really boosting your plants and supporting your soil life. I always recommend compost tea.
And if you leave it, if you leave that fabric down and then it gets soil or other things on it, pretty soon you've got yourself a big, great big mess.
Yeah, and actually a lot of plants and soil life actually mistake plastic as usable carbon sometimes. And so they tend to start using it as a growing medium, and it's not very nutritious for them. So it ends up sort of robbing your plants and your soil of nutrients if it becomes integrated into soil.
Jan, thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call. Pat in Elm Grove wonders, what do you think about straw versus mulch in the garden and flower beds? Or so what about straw as mulch in the garden?
Yeah, and I have a pretty extensive section on that because there are lots of good times to use straw. The thing with straw, though, is that especially like in a vegetable bed or flower garden where you've got high fertility, it's kind of really loved by a lot of soil decomposers and like worms and things. So they tend to break it down really quickly. And so sometimes if you put on too thick of a layer of straw, it actually raises the temperature of your soil. So if you want to raise the temperature of your soil, like in early spring, it's great. But in the middle of summer, adding a bunch of straw underneath things can actually heat the soil up a little bit more and draw the attention of all the microlife in the soil. It takes up their resources and energy, and so it can kind of stunt your plants at exactly the wrong time. So I love straw as like a winter amendment. I love it in early spring to help warm up the soil, but I avoid putting it on in summer. So it's really just kind of timing. So in summer, I tend to stick to like leaf compost, a really, really aged compost that's not going to put a lot of biological demand on the soil, but still is going to protect the plants and reduce some weeds.
Bev wonders if you, in an email, if you plant your lawn in prairie versus grass, would that eliminate Creeping Charlie?
There are a lot of different sort of meadow plants that would outcompete it. So it would certainly slow the Creeping Charlie down. It will probably still be there, but it won't necessarily be a dominant plant. And it might not matter so much, especially if you are focusing on taller plants, because they're not going to be competing for sun resources.
And as a matter,
it could also stop seedlings from germinating. So if you're planning on just annuals, it's not really going to work because they won't be able to germinate as well. So if you do perennials that are a little bit taller, then they could outcompete the Creeping Charlie.
I would mention, as long as we mention prairie, that Neil DeBull of Prairie Nursery will be with us next week on Garden Talk on Friday. So if you have another question about the natives and prairies, tune in next week for sure, too, because he will be there. Tony from Hixton called but couldn't stay with us. He's looking for advice on how to grow ground cherry.
So ground cherries are kind of similar to tomatoes. So if you're having any success in tomatoes, then I would kind of use that same culture. But you can put them in between rows and, or in between plants as kind of filler. But they do still require high fertility. So you'll want to put them in a vegetable garden kind of atmosphere.
Yeah. And let's see, I had one other email I wanted to get in here, too, because I wanted your comment on it. Oh, Kathleen sent us an email. This is for Creeping Charlie. Iron X or similar iron preparation is supposed to be safe organic weed killer and maybe make your lawn really green. Iron X, do you know anything about that?
Well, I certainly know about adding iron for greening up a lawn. And before you go adding any kind of sort of enduring long time kind of metal, I would get a soil test just to make sure that that's really going to be beneficial, because you don't want to end up overloading on any of those kind of supplemental nutrients. So it might be beneficial, but not if your soil has maybe an excess of that already. So sometimes it's just that maybe your soil pH has changed, and so you might need to adjust the pH so that your plants can uptake more iron. So if you just apply more iron, you're just adding more iron instead of actually addressing a pH problem.
We have a number of different soil types here in Wisconsin, and we have one area that's called the Central Sands area of Wisconsin.
Mm, yeah.
And what about sandier soils, and how do you increase water retention with a sandy soil?
Yeah, and sand is, the nice thing about it is it doesn't tend to get those mineral accumulations because it leaches out so many of them. But the hard part is increasing the water retention. And there are really two things you need to focus on for that, and that's adding more organic matter. Compost is usually the best source. And increasing the biological life, because in sand is everything just runs through it. But when you actually increase your bacteria and your fungi and things in your soil, your sandy soil, they sort of create like a glue, and they hold that organic matter to the sand particles, and so they increase moisture retention. So just adding compost, you know, is not always going to be enough for sandy soils. You may also want to think about like what you're growing, plants that actually encourage a lot of biological life, and also using regular amendments like compost tea so that you just keep supporting those biological life forms, you know, until the populations really become thriving. But with sand, as often as you can add organic matter, I would, because yeah. It will be able to take huge amounts. You don't want to do too much because you don't want it to sort of become anaerobic and start to smell. And so just put on an inch every time looks like it needs an inch.
As I've said during the show, I've really enjoyed your book, Weed Free Gardening, Tasha. And I like it, well, the organization, you're a good writer, and also the great photos in it, but how do people get copies of the book? Any of the bookstores, I would imagine.
Yeah, the publisher is Cool Springs Press, and they're a division of Quarto. So you can go to Quarto News is their website. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Any of your independent bookstores could certainly order it for you. So any way you normally get books, if they don't have it, then I'm sure they can order it for you. So, and you can also find me on my website at simplestead.com, and I've got links in there as well.
And it's Simplestead, right?
Yes, it's a contraction of simple and homestead, so it's Simplestead.
Well, it's been great talking with you, Natasha. Would you come back and be with us again sometime?
Absolutely, Larry. I love talking to you, and your audience is terrific. I know it's Earth Day, and I do just want to share a wish that one of your, it's an herbalist there in Wisconsin. She's in Appleton, Wisconsin, and it's called Barbary Herbal, and her name is Robin. And she had posted, how are you celebrating Earth Day? And she said, today I will eat the dandelions and not spray them. And I think that's, in honor of Earth Day, if you can all go out and find a weed that you love, to either eat or use in your compost pile or decorate your garden with, I think that would be a good thing to do.
Thanks, Tasha. Tasha Greer, her book, Weed Free Gardening, A Comprehensive and Organic Approach to Weed Management. It was fun talking with her. Monday, we'll take a look at a new exhibit on Leonardo da Vinci's inventions at the History Museum. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.